The Tom Woods Show, episode 1238.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, we spend one-third of our lives asleep, so it's important to be comfortable. And the Woods family has just jumped on board the Casper mattress bandwagon. Join me by taking $50 off select mattresses at casper.com/woods. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here, still in New York, and a lot of noise in the background, so you may hear that. Makes the episode more authentic. We've got Dan McCarthy with us today. He edits Modern Age, which is a very important, venerable conservative journal going back to the 1950s. He's also editor-at-large of The American Conservative magazine. And Dan is going to talk to us about two books with the same title, one much more recent than the other. The more recent one is Suicide of the West by Jonah Goldberg, and the one from, I guess, the 1960s is Suicide of the West by James Burnham. And they have very different diagnoses of what's going on and what's going wrong in the West, and I think their very different approaches can, you know, help us maybe make a little bit more sense of what's going on today. But also, it would be interesting, probably, to try to get to the bottom of which one is hitting the nail closer to the head, let's say. So let's do that. I'll link to all the books on the show notes page, of course. So let's jump right in with Dan McCarthy, who's very smart, very knowledgeable about all this stuff, and my natural automatic go-to guy with a topic like this. Dan, welcome back.
Thanks, Tom. Delighted to be here.
I have read the James Burnham Suicide of the West. I've not read the Jonah Goldberg one, so I'm not going to say anything that would be critical of that book because I always thought that's unfair just because I've heard what other people say. But I do know the general thesis and we can discuss that, and you know the books quite well. I have to say, after going through and examining the thesis of each of these books, I don't feel entirely at home with either one of them. I can understand them. I can understand why some people do feel allegiances to these two ways of thinking. I still feel like I'm a third way, but I still don't, as I say, it's kind of like the more I hang around with conservatives, yeah, I hang around with conservatives and I feel like a libertarian, and I hang out with some libertarians and they make me feel like a conservative, you know? So anyway, and when I hang out with neocons, I just want to jump out a window. So let's try and examine this first by, I guess if you could introduce James Burnham, because I think people know Jonah Goldberg from online, but James Burnham has not really been a presence for most people. I have Suicide of the West on my shelf that I bought from the Conservative Book Club when I was probably 18 years old, but I bet most people don't. So first of all, who was he?
Yeah, James Burnham was a professor at New York University, a philosophy professor, in the years before World War II. And while he was an academic, he became influential within American Trotskyist circles. So, I think our friend Justin Raimondo might point to that to say that Burnham was kind of a prototype in that regard of neoconservatives. He was a Trotskyist who later became a conservative. But that kind of stereotyping kind of gets him wrong. Burnham, in fact, was a very interesting thinker, and he migrated away from Trotskyism and started revising the Marxism that he had sort of imbibed early on in his career and started doing his own original thinking and sort of comparing Marx with Machiavelli and with a number of very interesting sort of Italian thinkers. People like Vilfredo Pareto, for example, who's an important philosopher and economist, as well as a political theorist. So James Burnham, in the 1940s, starts writing a series of books that really reflect upon the world as it existed at that point, and up to a fairly accurate degree, really reflects the world that we live in now as well. So in 1941, he writes a book called The Managerial Revolution, which is about how the economic system that we have today is neither classic capitalism nor what, you know, Marx envisioned as socialism or communism. It's some sort of strange new hybrid where bureaucrats and managers have the upper hand and control the economies both of the United States and also of totalitarian regimes like Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union. And then in 1944, Burnham writes a book called The Machiavellians, where again he explores the tradition of people like Gaetano Mosca and Vilfredo Pareto, kind of looking at how the power politics ideas of these thinkers who are in the tradition of Machiavelli provide an opening for freedom and liberty by checking power with other kinds of power. So it's a very interesting book, and it looks not only at pure politics, but also at psychology and how different psychological backgrounds and makeups lead to people adopting one kind of politics or another. Politics for Burnham is almost always a sort of facade for deeper psychological tendencies that people have. Well, then in the 1950s, Burnham becomes one of the founders of National Review. And in fact, he's someone that Bill Buckley, the editor-in-chief of National Review, looks up to as almost a father figure. And Burnham was in the OSS and later the CIA. And he was kind of a mentor to Buckley, in the CIA as well as through National Review. So again, I think our friends, people like Justin Raimondo would point to Burnham and say, here's kind of the beginning of where conservatism got in bed with the deep state and became, influenced by what would ultimately become neoconservatism. But again, I think that's a little bit of an oversimplification. Burnham really is kind of an original and interesting thinker. And then the final book he writes in 1964 is called The Suicide of the West. And its thesis is that liberalism is the ideology of Western suicide. Now, that actually means something very specific. It doesn't mean that liberalism is what's leading to the West losing the Cold War, for example, or the West succumbing to political correctness and other sorts of left-wing ideas. What it means, in fact, is that liberalism is the justification for all of these forms of Western decline, rising crime rates, for example, being another one of those. That liberalism is simply a way of the West justifying to itself why it seems to be losing its grip on power. So Burnham is, someone that I think is always worth rediscovering, but looking at with a certain critical distance. One doesn't want to simply accept wholesale all that he says about, economics or politics. Certainly in Suicide of the West in 1964, he's talking about a lot of civil rights issues and apartheid in South Africa and other things, which, really are in ways that are very troubling to conservatives and to libertarians, as well as to liberals. But he's providing in Suicide of the West kind of a checklist or a diagnostic that shows just the kinds of positions and issues that tend to mark out people who are right-wing from people who are left-wing. And he does that in order to show kind of how pervasive and influential liberalism really is.
If I were recording this from my home office, and I'm not, I'm in a hotel in New York, but if I were in my home office, I would have pulled off my shelf my copy of Suicide of the West, because one of the things I actually remember most vividly about it is, use the word checklist, there is a part of the book where he does go through a series of propositions that most people reflexively believe, and he more or less says, all right, the more of these you believe, the more likely you are to be a liberal. And I was looking at them, and I thought, oh, no, this isn't what I wanted to conclude. Am I remembering that right? Because we're talking almost 30 years since I read it.
You're remembering that correctly. And, 1964 was the year that we had Lyndon Johnson versus Barry Goldwater election. The civil rights movement was kind of in full gear. So Burnham is reflecting some of the prejudices of his time. It was also, of course, a point where the Cold War was still quite hot. So this checklist that Burnham provides that's supposed to differentiate conservatives and liberals really looks pretty shocking, even to conservatives today, and certainly to libertarians at any time. Interestingly enough, Burnham does seem to allow that libertarians are not necessarily just left-wing liberals, which is interesting because Burnham had no real sympathy for libertarianism, but he does acknowledge that they're not simply another variety of left liberals. So he says a couple of things in the book, one of them being that, first of all, libertarian anarchists, anarcho-libertarians, and I think he does actually mean Murray Rothbard, are a ideology that's distinct from both conservatism and liberalism. And he doesn't really go into the details there, but he basically has a few lines where he says, you can't apply the framework that Burnham has worked out to someone like Rothbard or to an anarchist in the same way that you would to these other ideologies. And the other thing he notes is that you can have people like Friedrich Hayek or Milton Friedman, who, would self-identify as being, libertarians or old Whigs, but nonetheless, Burnham classifies them with conservatives. So there are some interesting nuances to the book that are a little bit unpredictable based on just the sort of checklist that he provides.
Let's stick with Burnham for a minute. In fact, I remember, by the way, one of the propositions was something like, imperialism is always wrong. And I remember thinking, darn it, I think I do believe in that. this is terrible. Anyway, I want to know, let's get specific. What would Suicide of the West look like to him? What does he mean by the West committing suicide? What does it look like after this has happened?
Well, you know what? It speaks directly to that question of imperialism. Burnham says that one of the things that inspired him to write the book was he looked at an old atlas from the early part of the 20th century, from before World War II, before even World War I, I believe. He looks through the atlas and he sees this sort of ocean of pink upon the land masses of the world. That ocean of pink being, of course, the British Empire. The British Empire was so wide-ranging, it was the empire on which the sun never set. You know, everything from Canada to India, you know, all across the globe, you could find this sign of British political and military power. And if you looked, you know, at other European empires at the sort of early part of the 20th century, you saw a similar, if somewhat smaller, picture. So based on the way the map looked, you know, around 1910, you would say that the West, you know, this little sort of promontory of Asia, this almost, you know, peninsular landmass in some ways, had somehow conquered the entire world, not just through imperialism, but through everything that came attached to imperialism, with the economic and the cultural influence that came with, or that was, you know, sort of parallel to the spread of imperial power. So in 1910, you know, the world, the map of the globe is painted in the colors of the European empires. And then if you fast forward, you know, up to 1964, you see that those colors go away and that suddenly Britain is reduced to just, you know, just Britain, no longer a British empire. And not only that, but you also see the growth of communism. You see that, you know, you have the Soviet Union at that point. Obviously, Russia is still the largest country in the world today, but the Soviet Union was even larger in 1964. And communism had taken hold in the People's Republic of China already by that point. Communism was sweeping across the Asian landmass. And, you know, as were, you know, in other places, India and Africa, anti-colonial movements. So Burnham was shocked to just think about the implications of the map and the idea that Western civilization, instead of being in an expansionist phase, was now suddenly in a contracting phase.
I'm trying to think this through about what would be the problem with Western civilization then. Okay, it's true, it was in a contracting phase. But once it finishes that contracting phase, it then stays in a basically stable phase in terms of territory and influence, more or less. Is that not an equilibrium? Are you either expanding or contracting?
Burnham doesn't see it that way. So first of all, Burnham does have this fundamental view that you are either expanding or contracting, that there's no sort of equipoise to be reached here. And that's, you know, a point where we might disagree with him, but nonetheless, it's an interesting thesis, and it does sort of inform the rest of his views. But there are reasons to think that contraction doesn't stop once you get back to the actual borders of the West, because then, for example, you see the rise of, you know, the term multiculturalism didn't exist so much in 1964, but you see the rise of anti-Western ideologies within the West itself. Certainly communism being one of those, but also the idea that, you know, you had these sort of sympathetic, you know, movements that wanted to have, like, Che Guevara, for example, as a symbol of anti-imperialism. So the anti-imperialist ideal, which, you know, libertarians and classic conservatives, you know, kind of look at in one way, someone like James Burnham looks at it in another way. He sees the way in which the sort of hardcore anti-American, anti-West latches onto anti-imperialism as kind of the facade for its, you know, sort of anti-Western and, you know, anti-capitalist and anti-constitutional points of view. It looks at how, you know, anti-imperialism takes Che Guevara and Mao Zedong in the 1960s as being these heroes of, you know, throwing out the Western imperialist. And Burnham says, you know, this is a big problem. And this actually represents a force that is here in our own country as well, and that is trying to destroy the rule of law, for example, that's very much on the side of criminals as opposed to law-abiding citizens. And ideologically speaking, he also says that it's interesting that even though liberals don't consider themselves to be as far left as communists or as far left as people who might admire Che Guevara, that nonetheless, liberals are very weak and very passive in the face of aggressive radicalism from the left, that liberals are always prepared to accommodate it. And Burnham thinks that, too, is a symptom of the West committing suicide, not just by contracting imperially, but also by really opening its own mind within its own countries to anti-Western ideas.
Dan, let me take a minute to thank the Casper people for making our lives a lot better. My daughter, Regina, told me the other day, my mattress is really uncomfortable. You could feel the springs coming up through the mattress. I said, well, how are you sleeping on this thing? Why did you tell me about this? So I thought, wait a minute, I deal with the Casper Mattress Company. Let's get a Casper mattress for Regina. It is the most comfortable thing I have ever had the privilege of lying down on. So it really is true. Casper products are indeed designed to mimic human curves, so they provide supportive comfort for all kinds of bodies. It helps you sleep cool and regulates your body temperature throughout the night. It combines multiple supportive memory foams for a quality sleep surface with the right amounts of both sink and bounce. Delivered right to your door in a small, how do they do that size box. And in fact, we looked at the box and said, how do they do that? Free shipping and returns in the U.S. and Canada, and you can be sure of your purchase with Casper's 100-night risk-free Sleep On It trial. Get $50 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/woods and using promo code WOODS at checkout. That's casper.com/woods and promo code WOODS at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. All right, let's shift over to Jonah Goldberg now, and then we can do some comparing. So Jonah Goldberg also has a book called Suicide of the West. You note that he does not acknowledge the Burnham book of the same name, or Burnham himself, until about 100 pages in. And even there, he's not really all that. It's not very helpful what he has to say about Burnham. But the subtitle of the Goldberg book gives you an indication of what, of course, he thinks is causing the suicide of the West. What are the contributing factors? And it's identity politics and tribalism and democracy is decaying and stuff like that, which, I mean, I'm not sure that's the cause, of course, but what's his overall thesis? You tell me, because you've read it and I have.
Yeah, in some ways, I think his publishers did him a disservice by recommending the title Suicide of the West. It's a dramatic title, and you know, it has a certain echo in the minds of conservatives who've read James Burnham. But Goldberg has written a very different book, and he really didn't intend it to be an answer to Burnham. The title is simply, I think, one that the publishers thought would be snappy enough to become a bestseller, and in that they were correct. Goldberg is basically defending a certain kind of, I don't know, it might be called a chastened neoconservatism, it might be called a kind of liberal conservatism. He's defending basically a, you know, what a lot of never Trump people would consider mainstream conservatism of the American Enterprise Institute variety. And in fact, Goldberg is an AEI chair in what AEI has called applied liberty. So it's basically the kind of ideology of not just the Republican Party, but of movement conservatism. But Goldberg is basically saying that it needs to get back to its quasi-libertarian roots, classical liberal roots. But he sees those as being entirely derived from the Enlightenment. So in some ways, if people are familiar with, for example, Steven Pinker and his defenses of the Enlightenment, he wrote a book called Enlightenment Now earlier this year. Goldberg is doing kind of a conservative movement version of the Steven Pinker defense of the Enlightenment. Goldberg says that ideas have to come first, that the ideas are going to be ideas of a certain kind of individualism, and rule of law, things that sound pretty nice, but that in practice really can mean anything from proper libertarianism all the way through to, you know, outright neoconservatism. So in that way, what Goldberg's trying to do is create a common denominator, I would say, of sort of all of the kinds of conservative or quasi-libertarian thought that are not identified with Trumpism or nationalism or what was traditionally called paleoconservatism.
So what Goldberg is more or less calling for, again, I'm trying to reconstruct this on the basis of things I've read, is that we recommit ourselves to the defense of universal principles that have made the West what it is. And some of those universal principles, certainly we see, if not all of them, coming out of the Enlightenment. That to him is the West. And what's happened is allegiance to these universal principles has begun to break down, and we need to rally people back to them. If that's right, if I'm explaining him right, if what he's saying is our politics are breaking down because instead of having a strict fidelity to reason and balanced argument, instead people are herding themselves into tribal camps and waging war implicitly, at least on a small scale, against each other on the basis of tribal allegiances. And we need to transcend those and get people once again to acknowledge the worth of these universal principles. First of all, just tell me, is that more or less right?
Yeah, that's right. That's the gist of it.
Okay. All right. So the difficulty he runs into And Jeff Deist at the Mises Institute got in trouble for pointing out this obvious fact, is that it's not clear that a lot of people actually go out and literally fight for universal principles. Now, maybe we might wish they would. I don't care about what we wish. I'm interested in what actually happens in the world. Do people go out and say, I'm going to go fight for the principles of the Enlightenment? I don't think they do. I think they do fight for things like identity and nation. Now, again, I'll get in trouble for even for saying that. I'm not saying I'm glad that that's the way it is. I'm saying that seems to be the way it is, that people went off in World War I singing and whistling tunes, going off to what turned out to be their deaths, their horrifying deaths, whistling patriotic tunes. They were not whistling, oh, I'm dedicated to the abstract pursuit of reason. And so the problem becomes, it seems like he's trying to urge people to do something that, if the testimony of history means anything, seems to run against their nature.
Yeah, I would say two things here. On the face of it, Jonah Goldberg's book is, I think, more appealing than Burnham's, you know, in terms of the ideals that we like to admire, the idea that, reason and a commitment to liberty in the sort of abstract or general sense is what should be motivating people, whereas Burnham is talking about some pretty dark things. So it's easy for people to, look at these two books and say, gosh, Goldberg must be correct because we find, his thesis much more comfortable than we find James Burnham's, where you talk about psychology and you talk about these group affiliations, and it seems just very kind of illiberal in a variety of senses. But you have to come down to the question of not what you like better, not which one is more, sort of comforting, but which one actually reflects human nature and the way that people behave. And I think Burnham has the upper hand there. One of the things I should say, though, about Goldberg's argument is that I think he really gets things backwards. He tends to look at, sort of these high ideals of liberty and of reason, and thinks that, from that you then derive a political community and you derive a blueprint of how society can be. Maybe not a conscious blueprint. He's enough of a Hayekian that he realizes that this has to be a kind of evolved phenomenon as opposed to something that's consciously done. But nonetheless, it has to begin with the ideas. And I think that's exactly wrong, that in fact, we have a long tradition of, sort of Christian civilization, a long tradition of political powers which at first were very authoritarian in the West, but in fact kind of balanced one another out and, through time worked out to provide a framework in which economic freedom, for example, could flourish, and then intellectual freedom, and then the idea of liberalism could emerge. So I think Goldberg gets cause and effect reversed. The Enlightenment is not the beginning of, or the root of Western freedom. It's rather the opposite, that evolved practices of Western freedom that started out and in fact things that had nothing to do with an ideology or a philosophy of freedom gave rise to conditions that allowed us to create those ideas and to recognize those ideas as valuable. If you try to reverse it the way Goldberg has done and put the ideas first and the actual practices second, I think you wind up with something, as you had said, that people just don't feel a visceral connection to. They don't really feel a degree of loyalty to just reading the Declaration of Independence and saying, gosh, now I'm a Lockean, now I'm going to go out and do some homesteading.
I suppose Goldberg looks at the university system and he sees in microcosm all the things that he's concerned about, right? Because there you have quite a bit of identity politics. You have the opposite, in many cases, of a commitment to reasoned discourse and open exchange of ideas. I mean, you have the opposite of the Enlightenment to some degree in the universities. But on the other hand, maybe a silver lining to this, or maybe the other way of looking at it, is that outside the universities, there does not seem to be an overwhelming amount of sympathy for people who scream and shout during other people's lectures. I think the general public thinks that's a dreadful way to behave. And that's how Jordan Peterson has been able to get the moral high ground, is that he stands there calmly and dispassionately while kids are screaming. And as they're being dragged out, he calmly says, that's narcissism that you're seeing right there. And everyone laughs at those kids and cheers. And there was one incident, I reported on this in my email newsletter the other day, at Queen's University in Ontario, I think, where after they'd been escorted out, they began pounding on the doors and the windows. One woman actually broke a stained glass window. They were pounding and pounding. And he simply said, that is the sound of the barbarians at the gates. So again, he's getting the upper hand on them. They're cheering and laughing at these people. And I think they are a distinct minority that exist mostly on college campuses. Now, it's true they're worming their way into the workplace here and there, but people are only perfunctorily giving their consent to this. I think in their heart of hearts, they think this is wrong and that at root, part of what makes me who I am, part of my identity, if you will, is a commitment to reason and open debate. So maybe things aren't as bad as we think.
Maybe, although as far as Goldberg is concerned, Donald Trump's deplorable supporters are in the same basket as campus radicals who are protesting Jordan Peterson.
Really? Oh, okay, yeah. Here we have to have a talk. So how is that? Does he really think they're white nationalists just because they voted for Trump?
He doesn't go quite that far, although he, you know, obviously, sees them as being people who put group loyalties of various kinds above their commitment to, you know, sort of nice, neutral, liberal ideals. So he thinks that, Trump voters are basically as irrational, and that is a word he uses, as irrational as the, you know, sort of far left on campuses. And, you know, what Goldberg wants to get back to is, you know, I think a troubling question. I mean, if he's engaged in Republican politics, he doesn't like the direction Trump is going. Well, is that, a brief for going with Marco Rubio or Mitt Romney or George W. Bush? I mean, what exactly does he think was so glorious about, you know, the old sort of pre-Trump Republican Party? But he's basically, you know, sort of casting a curse on both houses, both the sort of radical campus left, but also really the people who are the most critical of the radical campus left, the people who are actually, you know, sort of on the right and are saying that, no, we like Western civilization. We like America. We don't think it's just, an oppressor. And we reject these, sort of crazies who want to go out there and shut up people who are talking about, you know, making good points about how to, you know, everything from cleaning up your room to just being a civilized human being.
So what then is he recommending? He's a never Trumper.
Yes.
But it seems to me there just isn't a home for me in either of these approaches, because I think if his answer is we have to revitalize democracy or something, that's just putting me to sleep. And Burnham just has too many ideas that are alien to me, so I don't fit in either of these cases. But what is Goldberg actually recommending that we do?
Well, Goldberg justifies the title of his book. And again, I think it was a title that his publishers imposed on him. But he justifies it by saying that we have a choice about whether or not we're going to give up sort of the ideas of the Declaration of Independence and, sort of the ideas of the Enlightenment. And, you know, if we choose to give them up, then we are committing suicide. But if, on the other hand, we redouble our commitment to them and, you know, focus on education and sort of promulgating these ideas, then that will be lead to the revival of the West. So he's stepping back, you know, a stage or two away from electoral politics. But again, I think that there's, you know, a question mark here as to just what this translates into. And it's such a broad vision and in some ways such an anodyne vision that it's hard to see that it's going to really lead to one particular conclusion, right? Because it could be a set of ideas that you attach to someone like Rand Paul, for example, in real world politics. Or it could be a set of ideas that you attach to, a Marco Rubio or a Mitt Romney or any other kind of political leader. And then as far as, you know, a sort of cultural concern goes, I just think there's a need to look much deeper and more closely at, our civilization's history and not simply to reduce it all to being a set of ideas that came up with the Enlightenment in the 18th century, that we really do have a much longer tradition. And a tradition that understands human nature much better than the Enlightenment did, which if we don't recover, we're going to wind up perplexed because, you know, ideas themselves, especially of the sort that Goldberg is talking about, they just don't have the degree of, they don't inspire the degree of commitment that allows you to resist people who want to tear down the civilization in which you live.
In the medieval universities, it was customary to perform what were known as disputations, and there would be representatives of two sides of an argument. And then somebody, some academic, having heard the arguments of both sides, would resolve the issue, generally by drawing from – it wasn't necessarily that you would pick a winner, but rather you would synthesize everything you had heard into some form of a resolution. And you'd say, all right, well, here's really how we ought to look at the question. And maybe we borrow 15% of what these people said and 85% of what these people said. But we listen to everything and we come up with some kind of a resolution. Now, having read both of these books and having your own thoughts, of course, what do you think is the correct way to look at the parlous condition of the West today? Well, what is the situation in which the West sees itself. What got it here, and what, if anything, could rescue it?
Burnham's diagnosis is more correct. So Goldberg's book has a lot of attractive ideas, but Goldberg is mistaken to think that politics is based upon ideas. He's mistaken to think that the wider culture war can be resolved just through education and Enlightenment principles. In fact, you really do have to understand human nature and human psychology and the interaction between power in politics, for example, power in the economy and power in the culture in a kind of sophisticated interacting way. And that's exactly what you find in James Burnham. It's one of the great things about his book, The Managerial Revolution. It's one of the great things about his subsequent book, The Machiavellians. And Suicide of the West is not really the place to begin to understand those ideas, but it does bring some of them together and apply them in an analyzing liberalism as it existed in 1964. Burnham understands, basically this kind of mixed, neither capitalist nor, classically Marxist communist economic system that we have right now. And he understands why this is connected with certain ideological tendencies, whether they're liberalism or whether they're various kinds of far left radicalism. And he understands why these things are fundamentally fatal to, Western civilization as it has been built up, over 2,000 years. Goldberg, I think, is looking at the surface of things, whereas James Burnham, you might say that Goldberg's looking at the sort of waves on the ocean, and James Burnham's looking at the fundamental tides. Now, that doesn't mean that Burnham gets all the details correct. In fact, that's where I think, there's, sort of good grounds to criticize Burnham. Again, that checklist of, views that he says have to be identified with, conservative tendencies or liberal tendencies. Those things are small details, which can be one can sort of gloss them, bracket them, put them aside. But it's the fundamental look at psychology and at the nature of power that I think, where Burnham gives us a very important lesson.
So even though it's an old book, oldish, it still repays reading today, even if parts of it might make us wince?
Absolutely. And, a new edition was brought out about 4 years ago in 2014 by Encounter Books. It has a new foreword and introduction by John O'Sullivan and Roger Kimball, which provide, a nice amount of background on who Burnham was. So I really do recommend James Burnham's Suicide of the West. I would certainly say anyone reading Jonah Goldberg's book should also read Burnham's book for the contrast. And, Goldberg's book is an interesting synthesis of a number of thinkers. He draws heavily upon Deirdre McCluskey's work. Deirdre McCluskey has written a number of, very worthwhile volumes on the nature of sort of bourgeois virtue and bourgeois dignity. So, I find that Goldberg's book has some merit as well. But one should really, cast a wide net. And again, not just go for books that have, sort of attractive, nice-sounding ideas that make us feel kind of safe and warm. But one should actually look at some of these more troubling books like James Burnham's and confront some hard realities. And certainly I would think that, the 2016 election and everything that's followed should be forcing even people who are very unsympathetic to Burnham's point of view to confront some realities about politics they may not have wanted to recognize.
I might add, by the way, that I'm always depressed when I ask somebody, so what should we do? And the answer always is, well, we have to try harder to teach these ideas and spread them. And he's halfway through that sentence and my head is in my hands. All right, I guess it's not going to happen then. I mean, that's your solution. There's nothing else. But honestly, in some way, what else could there be? But when it does boil down to that, it can be a little bit frustrating. But all the same, I'm going to link at tomwoods.com/1238 to both of these books, both Suicide of the West books. You can try out one or the other according to your preference. And Dan, I hope, I don't want to reveal anything. I'll just say, I hope maybe you yourself will have something to contribute to this conversation somewhere down the line. Is that appropriately vague?
That's appropriate. But in fact, even right now in the spring 2018 issue of Modern Age, listeners can read an essay that I wrote about these two books.
Right. I'm going to link to that. That's what made me decide to invite you, as a matter of fact. Yeah, I'm going to jot that down. You should read Dan's article.
Yes. And as far as the question of what can be done is concerned, here again, I think there's an interesting contrast between Goldberg and Burnham. Goldberg focuses on education. Burnham is not necessarily, he certainly isn't against education. But with Burnham, I think he says you have to fundamentally, again, understand how politics and economics and culture are all interrelated and sort of mutually coincide and lead to these grand ideological forces. Burnham, in some ways, is a kind of early example of an almost economic nationalist outlook of the sort that you find with Donald Trump. But Burnham's analysis in a book like The Managerial Revolution, for example, is something that libertarians, radical Rothbardian libertarians, can also find some value in, not because they're going to agree with Burnham's prescriptions, but because the systematic way in which Burnham looks at how an economy and a political system interact with one another is the kind of careful analysis, systematic analysis that you find, you know, libertarians also thinking about as well. Burnham is very much interested in the idea of class and its relationship to power, and so too are libertarians. Libertarian class analysis, of course, is an important but overlooked facet of the libertarian intellectual heritage. So I would say there again that one really has to have a keen grasp on the nature of power in the world today, as it relates both to economics and to politics. And if you're going to fight the power, so to speak, you have to understand it and have to understand what an alternative system, a different system, would look like. And simply going up to the level of ideals and the level of sort of vague general principles, as you find in more optimistic books like Goldberg's, is, I think, shirking the responsibility to sort of get down and dirty in the actual details of how power works in this world.
My friend Michael Malice has been urging me to read The Machiavellians by Burnham. I haven't done that yet, but how do you also rank that in terms of so many books are must reads? I would have to say I must have five lifetimes to read them all, unfortunately.
You know, there's a good case to be made that The Machiavellians is Burnham's best book. And unfortunately, it's been out of print for a long time and is now rather expensive even to find used copies. But it really is worth tracking down. I would say The Machiavellians and a book that Burnham publishes in 1956 called Congress and the American Tradition, which luckily is much more affordable and much more easily found, are probably the two Burnham books I would recommend starting with. Then The Managerial Revolution is well worth tracking down. Some people think it's kind of dated, but I actually think that, if you look at The Managerial Revolution and compare what Burnham is describing to what you see in the People's Republic of China today, for example, you will find some really revealing parallels, and that Burnham's 1941 book is in fact still rather prophetic. And then I would say, after those three, Suicide of the West is well worth discovering. So all of these books, they're all fairly short. They're not, sort of massive treatises, and they're worth discovering. They're worth tracking down.
So I'll link to all those books, and I'll also link to Modern Age, where you, what is your official title? Is it just plain vanilla editor?
That's right. I'm the editor of Modern Age, which was and is a conservative quarterly journal that was founded by Russell Kirk back in 1956. And the journal is still going strong. It is really the place to go to get, I think, sort of the best theoretical principled look at conservatism, and not just conservatism, but sort of all thinking, related to conservatism and related to the ideas of the right, including a lot of excellent libertarian thought. And I know you've contributed to it, Tom, and so did Murray Rothbard.
Yep.
So have a number of brilliant libertarian minds. We have actually a couple of libertarian contributors to the current issue, Deirdre McCluskey being one, for example. We have a wonderful review of a book by John Lewis Gaddis, who's a foreign policy guy, by a libertarian foreign policy analyst by the name of Emma Ashford. So I really recommend that listeners to the podcast check out Modern Age. The website is modernagejournal.com.
Okay, I'll also link to modernagejournal.com. And as I've said before when you've been on, just as an example, when Rothbard's multi-volume History of Colonial America came out, Conceived in Liberty, Modern Age reviewed every single volume as it came out and gave each one a glowing review. So just understand this is not, even though you will read some things that'll challenge you, and not everybody who contributes to Modern Age loves everything about you, but you will feel like, nevertheless, this is at least your extended family. And, your extended family is still pretty good. And you learn a lot from your extended family, and it's still your family. So it's very much worth reading, because it's not, there's no fluff, and it's all, frankly, high IQ stuff. It's not, oh gosh, more platitudes, and you just throw it out the window. You won't throw Modern Age out the window. All right, Dan, I know you're a little bit under the weather. I'm going to let you go rest, and thanks for your time and insight today.
Thanks, Tom. I enjoyed it.
All right, I have a cute and funny story for you in just a minute. But before I get to that, I do want to mention a website created by a listener. And a lot of these websites are libertarian blogs or some kind of thing like that, but not all of them are, and occasionally it's a business, and this one is a business, and it's a highly, highly valuable and important business if you are trying to promote something or sell something or be successful in your own business. You could well need the services of yadcommunications.net. That's YAD as in David, communications.net. This is a copywriting service, not copyright like intellectual property. That's not a thing. There's no such thing as copywriting, like you hire somebody to copyright your book. No, no, no. Copywriting, C-O-P-Y-W-R-I-T-I-N-G. Where you write copy, you write advertising copy or sales copy. So if you have a business or anything you're working on where you might need white papers, sales letters, letters to investors, speeches, books, ebooks, websites, brochures, flyers, menus, presentations, talking points, annual reports, grant proposals, magazine articles, marketing materials, scripts for radio and television ads, you name it. It can be done and done well at yadcommunications.net, and you'll be working with a Tom Woods Show listener. So how much better could you get? So yadcommunications.net is our listener website mentioned for today, linking to that also at tomwoods.com/1238. The person got the free mention because she got her hosting through my special link, and then you get the publicity, the backlink on my site, which helps you in the search results. You get the membership in my private bloggers group, and you get 24 free video tutorials. It's a great package of free bonuses. So how do you get those bonuses? Check out tomwoods.com/publicity before you get your hosting, and you'll see exactly how to do it. All right, anyway, I may have mentioned the other night that I was going to see Ian Anderson, whom I am very happy to remind you was the guest on episode number 3 of The Tom Woods Show. And he's the front man for the band Jethro Tull. He's generally touring under his own name these days. And he was performing at the Beacon Theater. It's the 50th anniversary tour for Jethro Tull. And I went with a friend. And beforehand, we just figured we would eat at a restaurant near the theater. So we ate at Playa Betty's on Amsterdam Avenue. And in walks Bruce Willis. We thought, isn't that funny? Bruce Willis just walked in. And then we put two and two together. Wait a minute. We actually knew that Bruce Willis was a progressive rock fan. There's actually a picture of him with Steve Hackett, formerly of Genesis. So we thought, wait a minute, he's probably eating here for the same reason we're eating here, so that we can be close to the concert. Well, ding, ding, ding. So I go to sit down. I got a pretty good seat. Who is sitting right in front of me but Bruce Willis? Absolutely great. And because he was right on the end, he could stand up in the aisle for a few minutes here and there and basically lead the cheers. So I'm looking at him like a goofball fanboy, grinning like an idiot and complying. And he's pumping his fist to certain parts of Thick as a Brick. And it was just amazing and fun. So it just made it all the more fun of a night. So I don't know how valuable this story is to you. I guess it just tells you this is something you missed out on. Unless you're Richard Schwartz, who went with me, you missed out on this, unfortunately. But what a great night. Absolutely fun. That's all I have to say. That's it. I just wanted to tell you that Bruce Willis just kept following me around last night. And I turned that into a marketing email on my business list. Because if you see Bruce Willis, you got to make an email out of that. And I, darn right, I did. And if you're not on that list, by the way, you can get on there at pathstoincome.com. And you'll see how I make a chance encounter with Bruce Willis into a marketing email. It's an art form, really. You know, and I'm still an amateur, but I'm getting there. My friends, oh, I'm getting there. All right, see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.